This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 13, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a case to decide whether Congress has overstepped its authority in requiring states to abide by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Representatives from 34 countries are in northern Mexico this week to participate in what's being called the Special Summit of the Americas. And legislators' terms expire in Haiti as the country reaches a political impasse. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Witnesses in Iraq say U.S. soldiers have shot and killed four civilians. U.S. soldiers posted at City Hall in Fallujah were fired upon with rocket-propelled grenades. Police and hospital staff agree that one man and one woman were killed when the military fired back. Four other people were injured. At a checkpoint in Baghdad yesterday, a man and a 10-year-old boy were shot and killed when U.S. soldiers started shooting after a bomb went off along the roadside. The bomb killed one U.S. soldier. U.S. military attorneys are challenging the constitutionality of the military tribunals in which they themselves are involved. Joshua Wiersma reports from D.C.
In a friend of the court brief filed this week, military lawyers assigned to defend detainees at Guantanamo Bay told the Supreme Court that some of the rules drawn up for special military tribunals are unconstitutional. The military lawyers want to find a compromise between the position of the Bush administration and the position of the civilian lawyers who brought the lawsuit before the court. The lawyers represent 16 of the 680 foreigners picked up during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. The military lawyers acknowledge President Bush's right to detain people, but argue he gains monarchical powers if prisoners who are convicted in a military tribunal are denied an appeal in a civilian court. Neil Katyal, counsel for the military lawyers.
When the president seeks to mete out justice and define crimes and punish certain individuals, that such determinations can't be done without some civilian review.
Katyal and the military lawyers fear the men will remain in a legal black hole, unable to challenge the jurisdiction and constitutionality of military tribunals. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Wiersma.
Palestinians living and working in Jerusalem are angry over the rising wall in the city. Israeli officials say the 28-foot barrier bears no resemblance to the Berlin Wall to which it is being compared. Rather, they say it is a reversible security measure. Michael Tarazzi, a negotiator with the Palestinian Authority, says the PA would support a fence but object to the location.
If Israel would like to build a wall, it's certainly within its rights to do so, but only if that wall is built on Israel's border, not inside occupied Palestinian territory. And of course, East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory, and that wall is in effect a de facto border dividing Palestinian communities from each other in order for Israel to expand its border of Jerusalem into the Palestinian areas.
Palestinians and business owners say the wall separates them from their work, families, and the constant flow of regular traffic that supports their community. This report is filed by Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C. The first votes of the presidential primary season were cast today in the district, where residents do not have voting representation in Congress. The vote will be non-binding after the Democratic National Committee pressured local leaders to bow to the tradition of keeping Iowa and New Hampshire first. Five Democratic presidential hopefuls even had their names removed from the ballot. The D.C. City Council moved the district's primary to the second Tuesday in January to protest D.C.'s lack of voting rights. Until 1964, district residents could not vote for president, and only in the past decades has D.C. gained the right to limited self-rule. Local leaders say they believe moving the primary is another step towards gaining equal voting rights for the district. Vice President Dick Cheney can expect a warm welcome on his fundraising stops in Seattle and Portland today, including from activists upset with the administration's energy policy. From KBOO in Portland, Andrew Stelzer reports.
Since June, Dick Cheney has spoken at 59 campaign fundraising stops. That's 76% of all his appearances outside the White House. He will essentially be in town for little more than the length of his speech, plus the time it takes to pose for pictures with $10,000 apiece donors to the local Bush-Cheney re-election campaign. Meanwhile, it's still unclear where citizens will be allowed to protest near the hotel. Kendra Kombrowski is with the Sierra Club. She is helping organize the rally against Cheney because the administration's energy policy ignores successful ways to produce energy.
This energy plan is pretty dependent on fossil fuels and actually takes us backwards. We really need to be looking toward the future, looking at renewables and alternatives, and basically just ending our dependence on traditional fossil fuels.
Cheney will be in Los Angeles on Wednesday and in Las Vegas and Phoenix on Thursday for more fundraising events. For FSRN, from KBOO Community Radio in Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the Bush administration can keep secret the names of hundreds of people questioned, detained, or arrested since September 11. Meanwhile, today, people with disabilities across the country left their wheelchairs and crawled up the stairs of courthouses in solidarity with a Tennessee disabled man who was arrested for not showing up to court because it was located up two flights of stairs and the court did not have an accessible entrance for the disabled. The demonstration comes as the U.S. Supreme Court hears that and another case to decide whether Congress overstepped its authority in requiring states to abide by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mitch Jeserich reports from the Supreme Court.
In 1998, George Lane, who is a wheelchair user, climbed two flights of stairs on his hands and knees to get into the Polk County courtroom in Tennessee because the courtroom has no elevators or ramp. At the next court hearing, Lane refused to climb the stairs and would not let someone carry him up, so he was arrested for failing to appear in court. Lane sued the state of Tennessee using the Americans with Disabilities Act and won. However, Tennessee claims state rights and says Congress cannot mandate that state buildings be accessible. On Monday morning, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on the case. Bill Brown, the lawyer representing George Lane, talked with reporters after the hearing.
That when in fact our citizens are confronted with those obstacles, they don't participate in government. They don't go to the courthouses to serve as jurors. They don't go vote. The confrontation that is required of individuals with disabilities to exercise their fundamental rights is something that ought to be considered abhorrent to the principle of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment guarantees us the rights of life, liberty, and property.
However, not all court justices agreed. Justice Anton Scalia said a lack of physical access into a court is not a violation of a disabled person's constitutional rights because, he said, people could be carried up or have the proceedings moved elsewhere. That position did not go over well with Beverly Jones, who is a wheelchair user and is also suing Tennessee. Jones works as a court reporter, and she says the lack of accessibility to the courts for disabled people makes it difficult for her to perform her job.
And as a court reporter and a mother of two young children who was trying to work and do the job that I love and enjoy, I was very conscious of respecting the attorneys that were good enough to hire me to not let them know of the trouble that I was having in getting to the courtroom in fear that that would influence their decision of whether to hire me in the future or not. So many times court was delayed and we would have to wait for deputies to get to me to carry me up the stairs.
Tennessee is arguing the 11th Amendment protects the state from ADA lawsuits and that the state is in compliance with the law if people with disabilities can still access services and programs. If the Supreme Court agrees, it could mean the ADA would have less jurisdiction over the states. The 11th Amendment for state rights can be trumped if the state is violating its citizens' constitutional rights, such as the 14th Amendment that prohibits a state from denying due process of the law and equal protection under the law. But Tennessee Solicitor General Michael Moore says Congress overstepped the line with the ADA because it has not been proved that people with disabilities have had their rights denied.
There has to be evidence that those rights are being denied. And of course, the mere existence of a staircase doesn't deny anyone a constitutional right. The constitutional right is to be present in the courthouse, for example, at all critical stages of the trial. And in Mr. Lane's case, he was afforded that right. I mean, as a matter of social policy, we don't disagree that Title II is good legislation, and its concern with the dignity of all Americans, including disabled Americans, is a worthy concern. That, however, is not a constitutional concern, and those problems would not have supplied an adequate predicate for Congress to pass this legislation.
Bobby Howard with Direct Action disagrees. He says with an unemployment rate of over 50% and the highest poverty rate, that people with disabilities face many of the same struggles as other oppressed people.
In Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, and the same thing that he spoke about in his I Have a Dream speech about equal access, employment, housing, and education, you know, basic civil rights, those are the same things the disability rights community is preaching for as well. So it runs hand in hand.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich at the Supreme Court.
Representatives from 34 countries of the Organization of American States are in northern Mexico this week to participate in what's being called the Special Summit of the Americas. The conference is guarded by an estimated 4,000 Mexican police officers from local, state, and federal levels. The largest protests are set to take place this afternoon during the summit closing ceremonies. Tensions between the Bush administration and Latin American nations, including Venezuela and Brazil, have been high during the meetings, with Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez castigating the various heads of state for their focus on free trade without taking social issues into account. Vladimir Flores files this report from Monterrey.
Of the 34 nations of the Organization of American States, Cuba is the only country in the Western Hemisphere that was not invited to this week's summit. Mexican human rights activist Miguel Álvarez describes the parallel between the exclusion of civil society and the blacklisting of a country from the summit talks.
Tendríamos que decir no a la exclusión y lo que está pasando en esta cumbre.
We should say no to exclusion, and that's what's happening with the summit. That a legitimate Latin American state like Cuba is not present is a precise reflection of this dispute of the hegemony of the United States versus the rest of countries in Latin America, and the weakness of other countries and their lack of a dignified defense regarding Cuba's absence is worrisome. And it's the same exclusion that's in this summit. Despite the symbolic presence of some social and civil representation, it is a fact that the summit reflects that OAS negotiates behind people's backs and that governments have not informed their people what materials they're negotiating and therefore do not have support for the treaties they've agreed to. There's an exclusion of the people, of certain organizations, of public opinion, and the declaration that today or tomorrow will be made public needs to be a wake-up call for us to organize.
The declaration that Miguel Álvarez refers to is a document of approximately 60 paragraphs that was pre-negotiated and ready to sign by heads of state. One key issue left out of the declaration was a paragraph explicitly setting a 2005 deadline for the signing of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. In one of the most contentious moves of the summit, language supporting FTAA did not make it into the summit's final draft declaration. This under the leadership of Brazil and Venezuela. Venezuelan congressional leader Nicolás Maduro.
El viejo consenso de Washington se quebró.
The old Washington consensus has been broken. Now things have to be debated. The Northern Empire can no longer impose its criteria, nor its paragraphs, nor its words, nor its concepts. And there's an intense debate on the principal economic and political themes of the continent.
Del continente.
Meanwhile, tensions are again flaring between the Bush administration and the democratically elected Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who last week called the U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice an illiterate and condemned U.S. intervention in the region. At a press conference yesterday, Maduro described the Venezuelan position.
Nosotros hemos sido muy claros.
We've been very clear with the United States, and President Chavez will reiterate this today in his intervention in the Summit of the Americas. Venezuela is a sovereign country that does not take orders from any imperial power in the world.
Washington has also criticized the government of Argentine President Néstor Kirchner for what they call warm relations with Cuba following a recent visit by Fidel Castro. The Venezuelan congressional representative went on to describe a meeting taking place between President Hugo Chavez and the leaders of Brazil, Argentina, and Bolivia to reach a common position to counteract the weight of United States negotiating power. In Monterrey, I am Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
Transportation workers continue to strike in the Italian cities of Genoa and Milan after air traffic controllers restarted their protest late last week. An estimated 1 million people took to the streets in a national demonstration last month to denounce proposed changes on salary contracts. Despite a contract deal, Italian transport workers continued a series of strikes leading up to the Christmas holidays, bringing buses, trams and trains to a halt in several major cities. FSRN's Diletta Varlis reports from Italy.
The Italian government had issued a date of January the 7th for workers to end the strike that started the 1st of December without facing charges and announced that it plans to introduce revision to the strike law allowing for more limitations on the working sector. In response, new strikes hit the transport sector shortly after the Feast of the Epiphany, which marks the end of Christmas holidays in Italy. The first strike affected air crews and airport workers on January the 8th. Flights were cancelled between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., with the exception of guaranteed flights. Urban transport workers re-began their strike on January the 9th, stopping buses, metros and trams services all over Italy. The strike has resulted in wide participation all over Italy Friday the 9th and Monday the 12th. Today, the cities of Milan and Genoa are continuing spontaneous strikes. Andrea Lombardi explains the atmosphere on the first day of strike.
Here the workers decide spontaneously to stop for the entrance and exit of buses from the garage. Since the situation is exasperating and the colleagues have been, fooled around by the agreement that the companies proposed, since they've given us just the leftover. Since it's not even guaranteed the recovery on the programmed inflation.
In June 1990, the Berlusconi administration enacted Law No. 146, regulating a public service worker's right to strike. The law created limitations that make it harder on unions and workers to organize effective strikes, including a 10-day advance notice to employers of a strike and the authorization of the government to block a strike and press charges against workers and unions that do not follow the rules. In response to the protest, Interior Minister Giuseppe Pisano authorized local police to press charges against strikers. After weeks of negotiation, a deal was reached early last month between unions and the government, but the majority of the workers is still unhappy with the terms. Public transport job contracts expired in 2001, and workers demanded a pay raise of 106 euros, $130 a month. Firms were proposing an increase of 41 euros. Trade unions and the transport firms compromised at 81 euros a month, plus one-off payment of 970 euros. But many workers said that the raise would not cover their loss of purchasing power since the end of their 2001 contract. Instead, the workers expected the condition of an agreement similar to the one signed 4 years ago that offered 106 euros a month and 2,800 euros in arrears. Emilio Salvatori is with the Italian General Work Confederation, or CGL, which is one of the largest trade unions linked to the left in Italy. Salvatori explains why CGL accepted the new proposal from the government.
We had to face a take or leave imposed by the government, given twice in 48 hours. The first of those divide us internally, especially in the relation with the other trade unions' organization. A refuse by our part in this condition would have meant nothing else but be on the street without working contract, because this government that is not a champion in friendship with workers, no matter what they say.
This last agreement, signed by the trade unions and the government, reset the contract signed 4 years ago, which included a salary cost of life increase and a recalculation for Italy's conversion from lira to the euro. A consequence of converting the euro is a near doubling of the cost of living in Italy, while wages remain the same for almost all work sectors. For Free Speech Radio News, we are Diletta Varlese and Thomas Bendinelli from Brescia, Italy.
Last week, the International Red Cross Committee, or the ICRC, arrived in Indonesia's conflict province of Aceh to facilitate the release of hostages held by separatist rebels. Among the hostages is a camera person. The Indonesian army is accused of killing his colleague, a TV reporter, when rebels tried to release him. The Indonesian army calls journalists who meet with rebels traitors, and the army recently jailed an American freelance journalist, William Neeson, after he interviewed the rebel group. The Indonesian army says Neeson is a spy. Our correspondent in Aceh, Megi Mariano, has the story.
Journalists and TV crews here in Jakarta are demonstrating for the release of an Indonesian cameraman, Ferry Santoro, who is held hostage by the Aceh separatist rebels or GAM. They say no more journalists has been killed in Aceh since the Indonesian army killed another hostage, Irsa Siregar. Ishak Daud is the commander of the separatist rebels who are now holding Santoro and the other 80 hostages. In the interview by satellite phone, Daud says the rebels are not holding the 80 people as hostages. Rather, they are detaining them. He also adds that GAM advocates freedom of the press.
Since martial law in Aceh was declared, the Indonesian army in Aceh controls all journalists here. They have to obey what Indonesian military says. The situation raises inquisition amongst our troops. Since martial law operated here, the Indonesian army organizes embedded journalists.
The Alliance of Independent Journalists, an Indonesian Journalist Association affiliated with the International Federation of Journalists, has found that under martial law, journalists in Aceh have lost their ability to report freely. Edi Suprapto is the chairman of the association.
Since Indonesia declared martial law in Aceh, we have found 20 cases of the military committing physical violations against journalists, and 6 more non-physical violations. Both the rebels and the Indonesian army committed them. Among the cases is the burning of a radio station in the Republic of Indonesia and the attacking of the radio crews. In addition, armed people shot at 2 different TV crew vehicles.
Yesterday, the government and the separatist rebels reached an agreement allowing International Red Cross to act as mediator in the negotiation for the release of the hostage. For 6 months, Indonesia rejected the involvement of any international organization as proposed by the GAM. Martin Untenaar is International Red Cross spokesperson in Jakarta.
The Indonesian Red Cross, the PMI, together with the ICRC, have been offered by both parties to be jointly involved in a neutral capacity in order to facilitate the release of people held by GAM.
Neither party has come up with a mutually acceptable proposal for the safe release of the hostage. Abu Mansur is spokesperson for the Aceh separatist rebels. He spoke to FSRN by satellite phone.
I'm optimistic that they can be released safely as long as the Indonesian army agrees to our proposal to delay crossfire for 2 days. If not, we cannot guarantee their safety.
The Indonesian army has rejected a temporary ceasefire. TNI spokesperson General Ahmad Yani Basuki has instead offered what he calls a secure corridor. The general declined to explain exactly how a secure corridor would work.
You know that Aceh is today under military operation. Therefore, any decision is absolutely in my hands. The opportunity we offer is enough for GAM to do something, and GAM should not have any problems in accepting our offer.
Meanwhile, the hostages still do not know when they will be released. Megi Margiono reporting for Free Speak Radio News from Jakarta.
Recent anti-government demonstrations in Haiti culminated yesterday in one of the largest demonstrations to date, with protesters calling for the immediate resignation of the country's president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The march came as Haiti's parliament became powerless yesterday as the terms of most legislators expired. The opposition has refused to participate in new elections unless Aristide resigns, which he has refused to do. Aristide, meanwhile, has been participating in the summit of the Americas in Mexico. Yet, as Cody Emanuel reports from Port-au-Prince, while the nation remains divided, there are some factors that unite the Haitian people.
A crowd of 4,000 protesters composed of civic groups, political parties, and student activists protested on Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, on Sunday, calling for the resignation of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Last Thursday, anti-government supporters launched a two-day strike that shut down most businesses in the capital. However, the strike failed to paralyze the city as government offices remained open, buses kept running, and vendors were out in the streets.
We have a dictatorship in place that does not allow Haitian citizens to gather freely and to express their opinion freely.
Andrea Pade, businessman and leader of the opposition group 184, funded by the U.S.-based International Republican Institute.
The crowd is a peaceful crowd that is growing and that is sending a clear and peaceful message. Mr. Aristide must resign.
He has to go,
but he sees the crowd growing before we go into very populous areas. They are frightened to hear the truth.
President Aristide's support amongst Haiti's poor majority, including small business owners, peasant farmers, small landowners, and sharecroppers, remains strong. According to government supporters, the opposition's unwillingness to participate in elections stems from a lack of real political support for majority of Haitians. Pierre Espérance, director of National Coalition for Haitian Rights, Haiti office.
There's been too much blood shed in Haiti. The police, whose purpose is to protect the public, is now committing criminal acts. The judiciary now serves the executive branch. Aristide's government must ensure that the population's civil rights are protected. Democratic Convergence must work to educate people on their civil and human rights and work to create a safe environment for free and fair elections.
This recent crisis, including growing political and gang violence in Haiti's provincial cities, have raised concern among Haitians and the international community as to how Haiti's problems can be solved peacefully and democratically. Armed groups have emerged in the town of Petit-Grave, Gonaïves, and Cap-Haïtien, conducting political assassinations, attacking police stations and government buildings in the hopes of destabilizing President Aristide's three-year-old administration. Government supporters known as chimeras have also attacked, shot at, and beaten opposition members with pistols, clubs, rocks, and bottles. Nao Marcellus, senior deputy of Cap-Haïtien, Haiti's second largest city. Elections in Haiti will always be contested. It is the people who give power, and they will always choose candidates who come from them. Haiti's bourgeoisie will not win power in the manner which they wish. 2003 is not 1946. From 1946 to 1950, the bourgeoisie held power and abused and excluded Haiti's poor. The apartheid system in Haiti is finished. We will fight to prevent social exclusion. Future elections will be held in the country and the people will always win. The international community and the bourgeoisie will never accept the results. Despite demands that President Aristide step down, he has refused. And government leaders say they won't buckle under opposition pressure to push a democratically elected government from power. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Cody Emanuel, with assistance from Semba Rumsa.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can go to our website for an archive of the newscast, www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.